With your permission, I've turned on the auto recording. So today is Tuesday, March 12th. I'm Liz Kreider-Reed, and I'm talking with Greg Harger, a.k.a. Coach. And as you know, Greg, I'm on the faculty at IU Indianapolis, and my colleagues and I are working with community partners to create an exhibit that tells the stories of our city's history of environmental harm, and that centers experiences of the people who live and work here. And it will contribute to a digital archive and an exhibit that will be displayed at Indy Park sites this coming summer. So I'd just like to start and ask you just to introduce yourself, however you want to frame that.
All right. My name's Greg Harger. You already referenced the commonly known here in the spaces along the river and the trails that we're working on here. People just call me Coach. And, and project manager for the Urban Wilderness Trail, which is hopefully the name kind of defines it a little bit, trail space that's been evolving here with many partners that basically below the levee from the where the canal water in White River State Park goes back into the river. Pathways below the levee comes up White River to Fall Creek and then up Fall Creek all the way to 16th Street. And then we've also, in the last couple years, partnered with and named a little branch on the other side of the river from 10th Street to the Belmont Beach Project near 16th Street on White River. So along what now will soon be part of the Hallville Riverfront vision plan for the park property development there and expansion of Moselle Sanders Park and then including the riparian spaces along the river. I've been co-chair of Reconnect to Our Waterways with the White River Committee and a stakeholder with the White River Vision Plan. And that's a start.
Okay, awesome. And since this is just audio, if you could just describe kind of where we are right now.
We're in Graham Martin Park. We're just walked up to the edge of the greenway, where we can look out into the forest here that's actually part of the Graham Martin Park properties. Part of the Urban Wilderness Trail wanders through this forest and is not marked yet, and those markings and signage will start to go in here hopefully this year as it kind of gets formalized and goes public. It's been a long, slow process to come together, and then in working in these spaces and meeting the folks that live in the neighborhood and helping with their starting a park advisory board, which is a process Indy Parks has for connecting kind of ownership for the neighbors and residents that live next to them.
I'm going to pause this for just a second because there's a lot of wind coming through the mic.
Yep.
Obviously, it's windy Indy. Let me just pause. Okay, great.
Yeah, hopefully we can keep the wind down to a minimum. It's spring. Now I lost track.
Okay. Where? So we're talking about the urban trail going in, and it's been a process.
Yeah, yeah. And it's in spaces that are flooded regularly. It's a river, and so it has some unique characteristics. The first level or shelf, if you will, that's the flat area right next to a river, is... floods frequently, you can't do any real development along those parts of it, but as you can see as we look out there right now, it's a mature river bottom forest. This area adjoining here was the property and area where the first ice company formed in the 1800s with Indianapolis. So they had a man-made lake. They would cut block ice and drop the block ice into limestone shafts. And somewhere I saw a newspaper article that on the history of this, that on a good cold winter and with a little luck, they could deliver block ice until the 4th of July sometimes. I would imagine that was quite a luxury, obviously pre-air conditioning, et cetera, types of days. But it also explains if you're in a kayak or you're paddling on Fall Creek, all of a sudden, it's sandier and rockier, and and you kind of wonder why it's like that, and that's the what we've learned is the reason that why it's different right there in this particular area. And then Martin Park, Ensign Graham Martin was one of the Golden 13, taught here at the school, coached here at the school, and those types of things. There's some credits in the park. Obviously, they changed the name of the park, oh goodness, sometime, my guess is in the 10 years ago or so, relatively recently, in his honor, from the historic Planter House home neighborhood and his connection with Attucks, with sports and teaching and all those kinds of things. And as I've learned from residents here, well, we've been doing projects along the river, and even we've used the park and facilitate the sport of cross country in here, which is pretty simple. Gotten to know a lot of the neighbors. Learned that this used to be a area right here, used to be a landfill. When they built the levees, things were just kind of bulldozed in, and they didn't worry about what was what when they built these levees after the Great Flood. I'm sure when this levee was actually built, but I know the levees started being built in, I think, the early 30s. The flood was in the teens, but by the time they got to doing those things to with the intent of protecting the community from that flooding, you know, these things would just be bulldozed in and over. And so whenever on the levee here, whenever a floodwaters come up, woodchucks, burrows, and they have pups, they will run up halfway up the levee and burrow like a cartoon critter with dirt flying, and run back down and get their pups and put them in a new burrow to save them from the flood. The dirt that comes out, I've got a plate with gold leaf on it, some old coins. It gives you an idea of, yeah, they just bulldozed whatever they had to make the levee. Back then, there was no concern. I'm sure there wasn't soil testing or anything like that. They just made the levees because they needed to make the levee. Type of thing. But yeah, when you get the animals burrowing in, all kinds of things come out. It's like, wow, this could be an archaeological dig of curiosities forever. And I think there used to be row housing along 16th Street that was kind of typical, with factories would bring workers in, put them in the housing, they would work and pay rent to the company, that type of stuff. So yeah, there's a ton of history here. And this time of year, the history, not being from Indiana originally, I knew basketball was the king sport in Indiana, and I knew who Oscar Robertson was. I didn't realize when I moved here right away, oh, he's from right here. He still holds records in the NBA, that kind of stuff, so it was kind of neat to having a background in a different sport, but still being aware of sports. Made it fun to be aware of that. And the Pacers Foundation's got that new court put in here and recognizes the history of the school, and they used to play outdoors on the court here for a long time, that type of thing.
Great. And by the school, you mean Crispus Attucks?
Crispus, right? Attucks High School. Yes. I've been in the museum once, and there's so much in it, even though it's small, and then the director there said they have way more stuff that they can't display because they don't have space. It's fascinating to see everything that they have. And to hear about the neighborhood, how it was built, and post World War II, how the neighborhood kind of all got together when in a very simplistic way, my understanding, I'm sure the all the homes along here, kind of the same plan, materials were dropped off. I think my recollection of overhearing the story was, if you're married, had a job, you were eligible, the materials to build a house were dropped off, those types of things. And then hearing the stories being shared, that we're pretty sure we were expected to fail, but we all got together because somebody knew plumbing and somebody knew this and somebody knew. So as a team and as a community, then they built the homes, and they're still... I think a fair number of original residents that still live here. But obviously, Father Time's undefeated. It's fading quickly, that kind of aspect of it.
As you know, this is a project that's trying to kind of surface the stories of environmental harm and also advocacy. Can you speak a little bit more about your work kind of in that space on both sides?
Yeah, I mean, the first big story that's kind of more recent, although it's, gosh, it must be close to 40 years now, the big chemical spill in the White River that killed all the fish, that type of stuff. And out of that, entities like Friends of White River were formed. And they were kind of ahead of their time and kind of on their own for quite a while until more recent years when, you know, now that White River Vision Plan and other types of things. But then you start to learn, and my workspace has really been from 16th Street to the White River State Park, about the industry that was here along the river. And the river was kind of the place you disposed of things. It really wasn't looked at as an asset. Matter of fact, you look at how buildings were and pictures of old buildings, the back of the building was to the river. And byproducts, things like that, just went in the river. And good luck to those downstream. Now, in the 1800s, a factory, it wasn't a pretty picture, I'm sure, to have animal carcasses floating down the river from meatpacking plants, but it's not the same as the chemicals dumped in the river that caused the big fish kill, you know, 40 years ago. You know, that was entirely different. So obviously, as industrialization and things evolved from the late 1800s, well into the mid 1900s, potential for things to be more and more toxic were pretty severe. I'm also on the board and work with the Belmont Beach project, which is just downstream and then around the corner here, but also up on White River on 16th. So we learn a lot about the history, both, you know, all the way through segregation and then the years that evolved out of that. Of Belmont Beach was the place where the community could go from Hawville, and a lot of the community was connected across the railroad bridges. Ooh, I'm trying to remember a gentleman's name that I met just a couple years ago. He works at the VA. He's probably right at retirement age, but he'd walk his bike across, and he said, ever since I was a kid, I'd come across here. My family lived in the neighborhood here, Historic Flannery House Homes, this area, and on the other side in Hawville. So the community had ties, family ties on both sides of the river, but the railroad bridge was the way to walk across. And it wasn't, that's a dead-end rail line to a lot of the grain mills and things here. So it wasn't like you had fast trains. And he kind of joked about that, you know. It's like, yeah, if you don't hear one, you can make it. You know, you just walk across. There's no guardrails or anyway, and you still walk across it the way it was then. But to hear those stories just from people who live here and talk about, no, when I was a kid, I started fishing here, those types of things. And with the industry, obviously, it went from relatively benign industry types of things that weren't that toxic to more and more toxic types of things. But it's certainly floating carcasses and other types of debris didn't leave for a very appealing river situation, but that was the one place you could go. You have no air conditioning, those kinds of things. So people would go to Belmont Beach, and it's a river. There's not really a beach. There's sandbars and things like that if the water's down. So there's places to recreate, but people, multi-generational, and more so on the other side of the river from here, because of my work on the trail there, that you run into people. And the stories, I've never recorded them. I should have someone like yourself follow me around. The stories, 19 out of 20, with anybody who's down there fishing that's elderly, whatever that is, they're down there. And the first time I came down here, my uncle, my dad, my grandfather brought me fishing here, and I've been coming here on and off ever since. And now that they're retired and there's now resumed access, we've cleared trails, opened up some spaces, so it's easier to go back in and fish where it had gotten pretty grown in and inaccessible. You get those stories of, and fond memories of, this is where you're in the city, but you could get away and you'd go fishing. And obviously people fish to supplement their diet and other types of things, you know, out of the 1800s into the 1900s. And then it reached a point, obviously, where there's still warnings today about what you can eat and can't eat. But the river is a lot healthier now than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. We have amphibians and reptiles that are in the life cycle now. They were not there 20 years ago. So there's a lot of improvement in the waterways, even though lots of concerns and lots of cleanup. Tangible cleanup's one thing. First cleanup we did, 20 years ago, give or take a year, between New York Street Bridge and the where the canal water goes back into the river, so just downstream from here, we filled 3 40-yard dumpsters. That's the big semi dumpster bin with, nobody'd cleaned up there. If we'd have separated car parts from everything else, I think my older brother who restored old cars could have built something. I mean, axles, fenders, not all from the same car, but just things that you wonder how they get here, but steering wheels, I mean, just all kinds of stuff that it was like, wow. What a story with getting the big stuff out. And once we get them clean, the wind still blows things in, floods bring stuff in, so we have annual cleanups all the time. But now we're not discovering, old things. But I'm sure in the mud in those rivers, there's all kinds of things. Been lost to time. But if they're not a visible hazard, no one finds them until they stumble upon them after a flood or something.
And in addition to the tangible cleanup, what do you attribute the improved water quality over the decades you've been working on it?
Time and people not doing what they used to do. Dynamic systems will clean themselves. I think people might want to take credit for one of the old stories. What was that, the 70s when in Ohio and the waterway caught on fire? There was so much oil or petroleum type things floating on top somewhere that something sparked it and you had a fire. Once you stop dumping those things in, it flushes out, it flows, it moves, it degrades, and time itself does a lot. So just stopping and I'm probably in the minority with that a lot of times working in these environments, with all different kinds of groups, KIB, parks, Indiana Wildlife Federation, Friends of White River. To me, it's just like, stop mowing. Let nature do it for you. Don't spend a lot of money on native plants because it's a big river and the wind blows and the critters drop seeds. Just pay attention to what emerges. And if you don't want invasives like honeysuckle or whatever, they're easy to pull out when they're knee high. So I'm kind of just letting it do its thing instead of you trying to force it. And my reference point is also a research study just downstream from here. The university's Center for Earth and Environmental Sciences. I feel like I get the acronym slightly wrong all the time. Lily Arbor Project, 20-acre study between New York Street and 10th Street, right down on the river. And the Urban Wilderness Trail passes right along that, which is really a service road right there that we've put some softer limestone on to make it easier, comfortable to walk on. They planted native plants that should be on an Indiana riverbank in one section where they should be when it's mature, a mature river bottom forest, and then another one they planted the same trees randomly, and the third one they did nothing. I don't know if Professor Barr likes my short version of his speech or not. But the bottom line is stop mowing, let nature take care of it. Because the river brings everything upstream down there, the seeds, there's not much difference. There's no essential difference between the three. I'm sure statistically there are, but when you walk in and look at it, the same things are growing. All of those things are in there. They've taken off really fast. And they're proving what I think everybody knows. There's a natural succession that has to happen with what grows in first, what comes second, what comes third, and it all sorts itself out. And that's nice to have that study right in this zone, that the number one thing you can do is ask yourself, why are we mowing all these spaces? And stop mowing them and not worry about spending a lot of money trying to speed it up when in reality, Mother Nature will do it as fast and better than you will. Man has a funny ego sometimes with those things. And for us, in the spaces that we've worked in where we've done some plantings, I go on a minor tirades now about, let's not spend, if you get grant money to do X amount, let's not spend money. Oh, there it is. Let's not spend money on natives from a nursery to plant in a space that they're missing from let's go out with people in the ditch just up the road on the other side, find hardier, same plant, learn something, spread the seed, and give it a jump start that way. And now we've educated some folks, and we got started what we wanted to get started. And they can take that home, do it in their own backyard, in a corner here or there, that type of thing.
We've already mentioned a lot of things that have changed over time, but that is one of the things we're curious about, that what have you seen changing in these places, but also changes in you or the people you've worked with, the kind of human engagement with these issues?
Yeah, it's... I was born on the shores of Lake Superior. I grew up in the wilderness. I always joke there were more bear in our county than people. I don't think there was a census on the bear. I thought it was normal growing up. my family and two other families, one was a Native American family, and an indigenous family from the area, we hunted bear every fall, which is, I thought that's what everybody did in the fall. Turns out they don't. And the meat's delicious, and if we made a crock pot of stew for you, that would be beef stew, you wouldn't know the difference. The texture's the same, the whole nine yards. But anyway, that growing up in that world and then leaving, going to college, doing this, doing that, I learned quickly to stop pointing things out that I would see, just as we've done walking along here right now, unless we start to point out. But I see sign, animal track, droppings, as part of just a natural process of growing up in a hunting tracking culture, that kind of thing. And then having an opportunity, people are like, what? To our right now, there's a nesting pair of great horned owls in that forest. And people are dumbfounded, kind of in surprise that in the middle of the state, there's deer, there's fox, there's coyote, there's North American mink, there's fresh beaver cuttings. The life that has come back in here, slowly as the habitat recovers on its own, is pretty remarkable. We've got two nesting pair of bald eagles that feed and hunt right downtown all the time. And so running into people that, okay, let's, like we're doing now, walking and doing an interview out here, let's go for a walk and talk about these things. And kind of early on felt like I was always having to explain to people, no, the critters are already here, the plants are already here, the habitat's here, you just need gateways, access, educational materials up on the paved greenway now, where people can comfortably, not everybody who loves nature and is all for things to be restored and healthy environment, not everybody wants to see snakes up close. Or the insects, or, you know, you can go on a long list of things, which is all I appreciate and understand. But for us to have a really unique, we're connected to historic manor house homes, we're connected to Hallville physically with the corridor, and then to be able to get to know people who live here, and then be a guide to reassure them that we're not going to get poison ivy on us, and here's some right here. This is what it looks like. Did you know the antidote is found in the moisture of the leaves from jewelweed? And here's some jewelweed. I had a book once. It was about Tecumseh, the Shawnee leader, late in the Shawnee Nation, and a big part, Indiana Territory was Indian Territory. It's why it's called Indiana, right? So, and the Shawnee were the reason. They were a powerful military entity of Native American network of tribes with similar language and culture. But there was a passage where the Shawnee would guide the French or the English at different times during conflicts, or even the Continental with the early days of the United States. And the author had some notes on the side that they had stopped, they were resting, and the Native Americans that were guiding them we've got an incoming bicycle here on the trail. We'll both move to the same side. Good girl. We have to make sure the dog and the leash don't get tangled up in the bike. The comments in the book that was pretty awesome was they were referring to British soldiers who were just infested with poison ivy and miserable. And they're sitting there having their meal or snack on their break. Should we tell them? Referring to the jewel weed, which they were sitting next to, which is almost always found growing close to poison ivy. And they're like, nah, they're not paying us to do that. They're just paying us to guide. You know, like, nah, their ignorance didn't deserve or didn't warrant being having that shared. But sharing those things through here and walking into the spaces and showing them animal tracks or signs of tracks or nests and that kind of stuff has been awesome, super rewarding and fun to see. I think almost everybody's a five-year-old when you get in and you can feel comfortable that somebody's going to point some cool things out. And then the hikes with the school kids have probably been the best. The teachers have the most difficulty. The kids are awesome in terms of when you point out circle of life things or a half-eaten rabbit. And it's like, no, this is, see the markings, see this, you know, and how it goes back into the whole circle of life has been a lot of fun. We've done a lot of hikes with elementary school kids out of school 63. And then we've had cleanups with the high school kids here at Attucks and the Met School just downstream from us, picking up trash and doing the educational stuff as we do it. You can see here to your right a lot of trees and branches that have just been cut. The elders in the neighborhood here remember being able to be here in the park and see the river. Everything we cut there is invasive. So you get mulberry, honeysuckle, and literally just taking out invasive plants, you can now see the river again. That was volunteers from the FFA convention annually in the fall. And so they came out and were a part of this. And then we'll... I'm pointing at a woodchuck. There he goes. He's gonna walk out and go down to the water a little bit. You know, their burrows are in here. And really, if you walk and sit down right now and don't move and had a good pair of binoculars, you start to see, oh, the whole thing is alive. And you don't realize how much is living in there. My best is to take people with a hike where we got 2 inches of snow on the ground. Because the critters leave tracks. They don't wipe those up behind them. It's not as easy to, you know, there's 2 turkey vultures circling over us right now. They're just looking for food. There's a Cooper's hawk nest in the tree over there. See the shape of that nest in the crotch of the tree up high? Mm-hmm. Normally you don't see it when it leafs out. And when you have animals here and you know what they eat, then it also gives you a clue of how much healthier it's getting every day. I think a lot of our drive and initiative and awareness of cleaning up things that have been damaged, picking up trash, doing all those kinds of things, a lot of the well-intended effort there is to continue to have funding and public support to do those things that need to be done, and we don't share the stories about how much is being recovered. I mean, people like to know. You just saw a common rodent. I think most people do see a woodchuck from time to time. But then to also know that you've got birds of prey here. They're at different little peaks of the food chain. They hunt in different spaces. They eat different things. This forest right here has all 9 of the native to Indiana woodpeckers in it, including the pileated woodpecker, which is the big one that's kind of, you know, a little bit more rare, red-headed, red-bellied. Flicker, downy, hairy. I mean, they're all in there. So just on one theme alone, you can go in and discover all those, and you wouldn't think necessarily you can find all those things in the middle of a city. You can't in this city. I don't think that's true in a lot of cities. So kind of the waterways and the neighborhoods that are connected to them, this space really is a gift. That, I mean, you couldn't build this. What it would cost to create this kind of oasis in the middle of the city would be kind of off the charts, but it's already here because of the rivers and because of the levees, and then people just ignored it. So it used to be dumped on, then we stopped doing the dumping, the industries moved, they're set up more responsibly, etc. and now it's healed itself without people realizing. You know, if you start mowing your lawn, each day you look out there, and then all of a sudden, holy cow, you know, it's, nature doesn't stop. And so it's always doing what it wants to do. There, we're getting some wind on the microphone. Are we okay?
It's a little rough, yeah.
We can face the other way, get a little gust. But the its own healing is pretty remarkable in a relatively short period of time. And I mentioned I grew up in the woods. I mean, in this setting right here, you can bring the research, you can collect the data, you can do all those things. But when I see bald eagles nesting and living here, the one nest immediately to the west, this will be the 9th year if they fledge at least one adult-sized youngster. It'll be 9 years in a row. And I don't, from a practical standpoint, growing up in the woods, I don't need to know what the count is. They're at the top of their food chain. It's all there, or they wouldn't be there. They're not stupid. They don't. You know, they don't build a nest someplace where they don't have enough food and the food's not healthy enough to have viable young. That's pretty, I guess that's my growing up in the woods hillbilly. The bottom line is, you can go do all the data you want, good for you if that's what you do, but I already know it's healthy past the threshold. Is it perfect? No. Matter of fact, I've taken the intentional picture of that nest with a Southwest Airlines jet going in, the two eagles and the nest. Because a lot of times people innocently like, aren't we worried about, I'm like, they know what environment, they're in the runway approach to the airport. They're just west here on Eagle Creek. No, and a storm blew their nest out of the tree 6 years ago, and they rebuilt in the adjoining new tree. So they're clearly happy with where they are. They don't have competitors, other eagles, in their space. And so they're urban bald eagles. They're good to go.
You referenced this space we are along Fall Creek as part of this broader system, and because we're interested in kind of telling a citywide story, do you have any insights in or things you're paying attention to as far as Indianapolis and its citywide toxic heritage?
Yeah, I mean, I hear things superficially that border around the area. I think there's an EPA designated concern area just upstream from us. If somebody gave me multiple choice, I'd probably get it right. I mean, I'm vaguely aware of those. Growing up in the woods, you always be friends with the people who live upstream. So I pay more attention to, just from a practical standpoint, I pay more attention to anything that's up Fall Creek or up White River from where we are because it comes to you. You know, that's just a natural part of it. For awareness of what's going on there. Turn of the century, you know, the city was a lot smaller. And then the evolution of industry, you know, there was this whole wave, and there was certainly a period of time where it was not good and it was nasty. And people's ability to access the river or need or history, you know, certainly put them or left them in pretty toxic environments. And now, we always repeat our mistakes, right? As people, as individuals, as a community, I mean, you always, that's the thing to guard against is to make sure. And I think nowadays, the ability to communicate, somebody's doing something wrong, it can fly so fast with social media. People, everybody's a journalist. They've got their phone and camera. I think those realities, I think, are really kind of a safety net, even though it's not organized, that's out there. So every day it gets better. In our spaces here, it's just nice to be able to bring people back out. And then whenever we've done things from the community, you hear the stories, what it used to be like or what they heard. And I'm sure those are things that you've been collecting with all of this effort of, you know, the uncle or grandfather or aunt or grandmother, or et cetera, you know, for us to open this view back up. That was definitely from the elders and the women that they would come out and picnic. There used to be a shelter right here. Between us and this one farther down, but you can see the river. You can see the kids in the open space. You know, it made sense. You could get outdoors and enjoy some space. Certainly, Fall Creek has flushed and cleared itself, being a smaller watershed than the larger White River watershed, which has upstream Anderson, Muncie. Those were heavy auto industry communities and all kinds of other industry, where Fall Creek was a smaller one. And I don't think, because it is smaller, rivers were our highways before railroad and roadways. So you know, the smaller watersheds that feed into this overwhelmingly are not bad. And that's where everything's sourced. So the ability to flush it and clean it, I think, is pretty dynamic and pretty active. Agriculture is probably the one now. And I think every day there's more and more leaving a boundary, leaving a margin. You know, all of this margin here, those roots, those, you know, those plants, that ability to sequester and process things that you don't want in the river are pretty phenomenal. Even just to walk in here in the middle of the summer, if we were down farther and walked into the trail here and it was August, you get an 11 degree, give or take, drop in temperature immediately. So this nature space is a little cooling island in the middle of the city. But it's a nice way to demonstrate to people that, yeah, I should put a tree in my backyard, you know, those kinds of things, just from a practical standpoint. Because you walk under one tree, you feel it. And that is easy to translate as opposed to having some long scientific diatribe that people glaze over, you know, as soon as it starts, I think to a large degree. But you walk in and get practical experience with a space like this. It's pretty neat. And it's emerged from just being left over. Like I said, you can see that's man-made stone there, where that drainage kicks out from runoff from the neighborhood, stormwater runoff. But it now runs off and into what's kind of a little oxbow where the river used to travel. And so now it's going slower. It spends more time soaking into the earth. And so you've got all that filtration from the plants and then the soil itself. And they used to just run these things straight in. That's the remnants of this. It went straight to the water. So it just jet rocketed in there. Just making those simple changes to let it spread out and spread out into not mowed turf. You know, you drop a hose on a mowed lawn, the water runs. If you plant a little native plot of natives with deep root systems, the water just disappears. And that's practical too, I think, for people. An easy way to demonstrate the value, you know, of some of those things that are just practical things. Things you can do in your own backyard. I don't know if I went off on a tangent there, maybe.
Not at all. No, I was wondering, since we've been talking about Fall Creek and White River, whether the CSOs and sewage waste management is sort of part of your radar.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In the corridor I mentioned, I mean, I'm pretty tuned in between 16th Street and the old Washington Street Bridge and the canal area where the water dumps back in, to all of the utilities that cross and pass through here, the deep rock tunnel, and all of that work that's being done, infrastructure being put in. The blessing for Indianapolis is the solid limestone that's underneath. It's allowed them to bore and put in those underground storage areas to capture. You know, I think publicly they talk about 97% or give or take of things will be mitigated going forward. The on-the-ground engineers that I've run into and talked to, who I intentionally don't ask their name, when they relax, oh yeah, I fish or I hunt, we have some commonality, and they relax a little bit and you get some on. They're like, it's 99.9. This is unbelievable what we've put in here. I mean, could you have an epic 100-year flood? And would that, yes. But, I mean, they're extremely confident that because of the limestone, because it's uniform, their ability to put all that in, taking advantage of that consistent geology underneath us was a real, you know, a blessing that you can't pick and choose what's underneath you, but it's been a big blessing for that part of it. And I think it'll come online soon. We're getting there now, where they start to connect the different branches of all of that system, and that's, you know, it as a city, it's our runoff, it's our mess, but it, probably doesn't change the quality of Fall Creek and White River much, because but it changes dramatically everything downstream. Again, water runs downhill, but so we're cleaning up after ourselves very well. And as soon as that stuff as each one comes online, that will make a tremendous impact on habitat, the things that are a little more fragile or a little more delicate, that kind of stuff. But like I said, we have amphibians in the life cycle now, and 10 years ago, good luck finding a frog or a tadpole other than one that got flushed down here if there was a storm yesterday. But now they're in the life cycle in a lot of these little places. And that should escalate a lot with that deep rock tunnel and all those branches coming online. Yeah, that'll do a tremendous job.
Are there, sort of looking forward, are there any changes that you'd like to see?
The things that I'm advocating for now with this space, other than, I think I mentioned, or if I didn't, I meant to, it was in my head somewhere. We have a lot of signage to go in here, the forest loop, the access to it here in Martin Park is intentionally kind of cut at an angle so we're not inviting people in when it's not done yet. But we'll be able to put the signage out and let people know kind of what lives in this space and what lives in the next space just downstream. It's an outdoor classroom for neighborhood schools and for people just generally passing on the greenways. The education is going to be up here where we are. I mean, most people aren't going to go down and get their feet dirty on the next level. They may not necessarily feel comfortable unless they've got a guide with them to walk into that forest, especially when you share what lives there. If you don't, the first time I went to a city as a kid growing up in the wilderness, the city scared the heck out of me because I don't know what the rules are. There's all kinds of things going on here and it seems dangerous. I'd rather be in the woods dealing with a mama moose than I would be dealing with traffic on a major intersection or whatever. But it's, once you get comfortable with it, so there's layers here to be on the paved greenway. And then in this corridor, we don't have it in front of us right now, but we've got limestone trail that's gone in just below. So it's in the open. And if you see, that's somebody that I can identify with, fitness level, age, whatever category you want to put yourself. Okay, they're down there. I can go down there. And some are in the works and others will come shortly thereafter. A few places where it's comfortable to zigzag down on an ADA grade ramp. And then it also will serve as, they'll be wide enough to serve as a service vehicle. So if something needs to be down there, a rescue for somebody who gets in trouble or just inspecting the levees will serve those purposes. So the educational part of it, just creating windows, doorways, gateways, and not touching this. Let nature do its thing. Although in places, certainly, we have groups and focus areas where here we've taken the invasives out to soft manage, keep those out so you can see the river anytime you come here. This neighborhood where we're standing right now, two winters in a row, although it's not over yet, we still have a chance. It started with my family and another family. If we get 4 inches or more of snow, the right kind of snow, I won't go on a tangent on different kinds of snow, but where I grew up, believe me, there are, so that it's comfortable to sled. So I have a little email list, Flash Sledding Party. We had 105 people out here sledding two years ago, the last time we had a snowfall. And kids from the neighborhood, families from the neighborhood, and we bring stuff out here, little typical sledding things, but also we bring a kayak and canoe. They're great sleds with a little instruction. It's mowed out. There's no trees, there's no rocks. And so they're just sledding all up and down here and having a blast. We had a gentleman from Jamaica visiting a family. He had never seen snow before. That was here in town. And we kind of had an official time, like from here to there, but it's not an official event. You can't predict when the snow is, but we just send it out and people show up. And we've got some nice little restaurants down here and people can go in and people from the neighborhood, obviously they go back home and they have a blast. But kids, we let anybody and everybody, we bring all kinds of stuff. So everybody wants to go in the kayak. And so we take turns and get them down there. But the guy from Jamaica, never seen snow before. And then he was like 5 years old and I'm like, as long as he wanted to go down on every single different thing that you could possibly slide on that we had out here. And I'm like, if he wants to sled till dark, I'll stay with him, because I was having so much fun watching him be a child with the joy of sledding. And, oh my goodness, it was so funny to have, you know, that kind of thing. And an experience with it. So it's some neat recreation. Now the first time, well, not the first time, second or third time when we added some people to the list, we probably shared it on Facebook or something. People are like, where are you? Because the pictures were this, not the city. And then we posted another time and somebody shared it with somebody else. And they're like, there's no hills downtown. And it's like, well, all right, stay home. But, you know, this is where we're doing. But obviously it's a levee. You don't see it driving by. You don't realize there's a run out here. So they had a great time. And then we did do a little, you know, what lives here kind of stuff, and did some things on the side for people that wanted to know a little bit more about what was out here. But yeah, again, an outdoor opportunity that you wouldn't necessarily get. And now I think it's taken on a life of its own. I've been by here when there's a couple inches of snow, and clearly people are sledding. Yeah, ground's too hard if you don't have, you gotta have a little cushion. But don't let me stop you from having fun. You know, so it's definitely carried on.
Incredibly thorough, but is there anything else you would want people to know or understand about your work or this place?
Yeah, just access and education from up top here on the pavement, letting people know that it's okay to go down there, and here's where you can go down or go in and explore, and making sure we don't leave out the history of the place all the way back to the first ice company and the history of the neighborhood and what else is here. Because now people come through this park with the greenway being open, and they've got to finish one last little part that would allow people to flow easily all the way through in and connect to like the B&O's coming, etc. The ability to make it a destination. This park has so much history. With Crispus Attucks, the school and the neighborhood, how it was built. It's just phenomenal stories. And now people will be able to get here, learn, you know, those kinds of things. And I think it's fair to say most of the neighbors, the elders, those that have been here that still can speak to the living history and things are not concerned about, oh, I guess kind of generically gentrification or anything like that. They just want their story to live on, and with the museum and the school and what they've done with the basketball court and things like that. And there are some other plans in the works to Indiana Avenue, jazz music, and I think that's been in the news recently, etc. You know, it's on one end of the park, to be able to have something about that heritage on that end of the park. And then the middle of the park needs something to do with the history of the neighborhood and the involvement in the service of military, police, fire, the history of residents here and their evolution into those careers and stuff's pretty groundbreaking and historic and very notable. And that's not been told either, just where they went, what they did for their careers, that kind of stuff, kind of in the middle of the park. And obviously the athletic part's already recognized with the sports court down there with all of the players and what was it, Hallie Bryant? I met him here in the summer a couple of years ago. He was in the Harlem Globetrotters Hall of Fame, and he out of the same realm. Obviously some played in the NBA, but it's kind of neat stuff. And you know, their pride and their memories of, you know, being here and being isolated but taking the attitude of, you know, we're going to take care of ourselves was pretty impactful and a pretty awesome story. Yeah, and now to be able to make some connections between that and, you know, you've got a big city, but you've got a huge tract of nature in the middle of it, and then the city has history that's probably not dissimilar than any other big city east of the Mississippi, just all of the things that transpired. So we're fortunate to have that space here where people can get a jump start on having a healthier environment. And there's a lot you can learn from this that you can take to your backyard. I mean, I guess that's the one part, other than just educating people about the space, encouraging them to explore it. Not everybody's gonna do that lives in the city. Like, okay, that's nice. I'll brag about it, I know it's there, but I'm not gonna wander in there by myself. But there's things from that you can take to your own backyard, to your own spaces, just plants, wildflowers, those kinds of things that are valuable.
Awesome.
Yeah, and I, we give them the access, and then the schools, they can continue on the and out of, you know, who knows the percentage. But I mean, if you're out here and having those experiences, some of them are going to take it with them. Teacher leaves, the programming's still there, and that's the probably the part of it that we're working on now that's fun, is the self-guided stuff that a teacher can pick up and, okay, I'm not an expert in this, but identifying trees by bark, by the leaves, those kinds of things, on a loop through the forest, finding the animal tracks, finding the sign, those kinds of things. A lot of it, some of it's pretty easy to point out or fairly easy to make it obvious. Yeah. And just sharing what does live. I have a lot of photos of wildlife and wildflowers, which are the easiest things, I think, and the most common things for somebody to just, on a generic level, to not be all in, like, oh, okay, I could identify this. To be able to have those up here and then people be able to find them or discover them. Nobody's diving in deep on scientific names of all the insects that live here, but knowing the monarch butterfly has a great PR agent, right? And knowing what milkweed is, you know, we've got some milkweed vine pods right down here. You know, people wouldn't guess that this space, in particular just downstream from us, we do programming every fall with the Indiana Wildlife Federation. And this coming fall, their only public outings will be in this corridor in the middle of the city. They got tired of going to other places like state nature preserves and having a thing where we catch monarchs and we tag them. We put a little sticky RFD tag on them, and scientists are looking for them in Florida when that fourth generation flies back to Mexico. And so it's an ongoing program. The most they've ever captured in a single day is in this corridor. The second most, in this corridor. The third most, in this corridor. We've never been shut out when we go out, even when the weather's bad. So, you know, you can find monarch butterflies are out here everywhere in the fall. That was not the case 15 years ago. But when you let the milkweed go, when I was little, my father's food, water, and shelter. If the food item and the shelter and water are available for filling the species, if it's there, they'll find it and you'll have them. You know, if you're hosting a party at home and you run out of beverages, people are like, oh, I got somewhere to go. You know, I mean, it's that simple from, you know, so what's the critter? What do they need? You know, when that stuff drops in, then they show up and they'll thrive and reproduce and the whole nine yards. So the monarch's a great one. You know, nobody's scared of a monarch, are they? I'm sure somebody's afraid of butterflies, but that one's been awesome and a great example. And we've had all kinds of people come and do those experiences. They have special little nets, and we encourage families to bring their kids, because once the kids know, I mean, I have a green light to run around and chase butterflies, and they catch them like crazy once they learn the technique. So that's been fun, and there's more of that you could do, but that's been an easy one for us to do. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing this place and your work, and also the beautiful hawk who has joined us for this walk.
Yeah, she did a good job. She doesn't bark much. We don't know her story, but oh yeah, I accidentally just put my hands, my daughter has taught her to give hugs. So if you put your hands near your belly, then you get a hug, good girl. All right. Which isn't necessarily good for the random persons who run into her. She jumps up on you.
Oh, well,
but no, been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
It's always good to share the space.